This is another session on questions relating to the ecumenical movement. August 17th, the title of this one is Tensions in the Ecumenical Movement, and I'm Dan Martinson convening this. I think you've all heard enough about those of us who are giving some guidance to these discussions, so I don't have to talk about that, except to indicate, as Larry did this morning, that I spent 7 years in Geneva as ecumenical relations executive for the Lutheran World Federation. So I look at the thing from a little different angle than the staff of the World Council would look at these questions, and that'll come through, I think, today in some things I say. And I'd just like to run very quickly through a catalog of eight basic tensions that I think are existing in the ecumenical movement. Some would even call them obstacles to ecumenical advance. But before doing that, I think we should at least be clear, in case you're not aware of what even the word oikumene means. I don't know if you've toyed with that word at all, but one comment would be simply to indicate that word oikumene, obviously a Greek word, and the root word for words like economics and ecology and quite a number of other modern English words have their roots there. And now it's come to mean the whole inhabited world and the whole church. So whenever some of us would use the word ecumenical, we would by that mean anything that relates to the task of the whole church, preaching the whole gospel to the whole world. And if anything touches that, you could call it ecumenical. So with that introductory word, and also in addition to that, to say that the ecumenical movement of the 20th century, some of us believe will be 100 years from now recognized as the most significant development in terms of church history of the last few hundred years. And I guess I'd predict that 100 or 200 years from now, people look back at the period from 1910 to the turn of the century, they would see more than that, turn of the millennium, they'd see that particular period of church history was the one during which really millions of Christians in the world attempted to concretely deal with the question of unity, of common witness and service, and the question of how we as Christians are to be obedient to Christ's prayer, that all of his followers be one. So we're talking about that movement, and we have dealt with it in other sessions concretely, what's happened since 1910. But let me run through this catalog and then open it up and let you pick up whatever out of this you'd like to pick up to discuss or probe more deeply into. One tension, which is very basic and has been for many decades now, is the tension between the doctrinal and the non-doctrinal emphases in doing ecumenical work. There's one group of people who would constantly be talking about church unity being realized as a result of everybody coming to agreement on some basic doctrines, understanding the Trinity, understanding the Eucharist, the doctrine of incarnation, and run right down the line. So it would be a strictly theological kind of exercise. And you find a whole group of people in the World Council of Churches who would emphasize that. Most of them are gathered in what is now called the Faith and Order Commission, which has a kind of semi-independent life in the ecumenical movement, and sometimes very distant from the people in the movement who say, no, the non-doctrinal factors are the key factors. Questions of racial discrimination, questions of language and culture, they're not non-theological factors, but they're non-doctrinal factors. So you find two emphases in the movement, and these two emphases are often in conflict one with the other. We could demonstrate that with examples from the last assembly. The people who accent the non-doctrinal approach would say the unity of humankind is our primary goal, and if we manage that and we work at it significantly, then the unity of the church would follow quite automatically. Others are saying, oh, we really have to talk about doctrinal unity first, and then the unity of humankind can be dealt with. So that'd be one tension. The second would be local versus global types of ecumenical initiative. And the oxymoron there is purposely stated to touch on this one. Some people see them to be absolutely separate, one from the other. And the point would be that those that push for local ecumenism, for example, churches moving ahead on intercommunion and merging churches, in spite of what their bishops might say, or in spite of what the church leadership might say, would be an extreme example of local ecumenism moving ahead regardless of the broader the broader state of things in the ecumenical effort. And others would say, no, we must centralize the movement internationally and then let things filter down and eventually. For example, the Roman Catholic Church would say, no, you may have intercommunion with the Anglicans or the Lutherans or whatever. And the tragedy is that those two emphases are very often in conflict, one with the other. So that would be a second kind of fundamental tension in the movement. Sometimes it takes the form of regionalization, localization, in competition with an international approach to the whole thing. A third tension is relatively new, and it would be the trans-confessional movements versus all kinds of other expressions of the ecumenical movement. And we're talking there about the charismatic and the neo-evangelical, neo-charismatic, neo-Pentecostal, all kinds of forms of this new development which cuts across mainline churches. You'd find it in the Lutheran communion, you'd find it among the Anglicans, in the Roman Catholic communion. And it would sort of be a horizontal cut across all these vertical world communions. An important step was taken at Vancouver in regard to this, with a very important bridge being built between the World Council and a large, large group of evangelicals. And if you want to toss in there the Moonies or the Unification Church and all kinds of other developments which draw people out from other churches and claim to be thereby ecumenical would be an example also of that tension. Takes lots of different forms. A fourth tension is really a tension between two communities of people in the church. One community being people whose hopes seem to be realizable and expressible. We can talk about the realization, even believe that some of our hopes will be realized, as over against large communities of people whose hopes seem to be unrealizable. And often even the expression of that hope is stifled and often has to go subterranean. It can't surface for whatever reason. And there we'd be talking very concretely about the victims of poverty and hunger, the victims of economic exploitation, sexism, racism, victims of political oppression, and sometimes it's simply a voice of silence. I was impressed in Vancouver at the change over the last few years of the voice of the oppressed, which very often has been a voice of silence, but at Vancouver surfaced very concretely and very dramatically. I think Arnold and others would affirm that. So you had a shift occur there, an important bridge built. That would be something we could go back through the list on a bit later and indicate where we've made progress on these tensions or obstacles during the last few weeks. The fifth tension exists between the people who are willing to address questions of power in the ecumenical movement and those people who simply do not want to talk about that question.
In the movement or
the question of power within the churches I'm talking about primarily, not power generally in terms of secular things. So, willing to address power questions in the life of the church or the individual churches, and those who are not willing to talk about it. In the last 20 years since 65, in the Second Vatican Council, there have been numerous bilateral dialogues. You're talking about, I'm getting technical language, but a bilateral dialogue would simply be a dialogue, say, between the Catholics and the Lutherans. And we've had international bilateral dialogue for 20 years now, and we have moved through a number of steps to an agreement on the gospel and the relationship of the gospel to the world and the church in 1972. And just within the last few years, two important convergence papers have emerged. One on the Eucharist, a remarkable convergence of thinking on the Holy Communion, and now one on the ministry. And that raises the power question. So a lot of conversations between Christians over the last 20 years or so have moved to the point of having to deal with the question of women's ordination, the relationship of lay people to ordained people, the role of the bishop in the church, who makes decisions for whom. All of those are power questions, and you can see a clear pattern in ecumenical work between a configuration, really, of those who will openly deal with the power question and those who will not. generally the ones who spoke out most clearly on this in Vancouver were women. Dorothea Sola, Elizabeth Bettenhausen, Caldicott, a number of the key speakers raised the question directly or indirectly of who's making decisions for whom in the ecumenical movement and the life of our churches. I'm convinced that, that because we are now tackling the question of ministry, no longer can we avoid the basic question of how power operates and authority relates to that power in our church's life. The Catholic dialogue did not touch, the Lutheran Catholic dialogue, did not touch the question of the papal office, left that off to the side, such a hot issue, as women's ordination is such a hot issue. But they did talk about the office of the priest and the office of the bishop and came to very solid agreement on what that office means in the life of the church. The next task, a very tough one, is to get at this business of the Pope and what they call the question of the universal ministry of the church, which is a term the Catholics use for the papal office. That's coming, and a task group, task force is already working on it in the International Catholic Lutheran Commission. They have a very tough job on their hands. So the power question will surface more and more from this point on in the ecumenical movement, and it certainly came up at Vancouver. A sixth tension, if not an obstacle, is one upon which very little progress is being made, and that is the academic versus the ecclesiastical. Back in the early period of the ecumenical movement, I found an old document in the archives of a meeting that took place in 1951 at Busse, at the Ecumenical Institute. And on the back of that document of a planning meeting for that World Assembly in Evanston in 1954 were the names of people like Karl Barth, Bailey, Niebuhr. We run down the list. The key theologians of all of our traditions were then actively involved in trying to brainstorm about the theme for the Evanston Assembly. The contemporary ecumenical movement draws different kinds of theological resources. People like Pannenberg and Moltmann and others are in the faith and order work, but invisible at a meeting like the one we just had in Vancouver. So you find a separation between the theological seminaries and the theologians of our church and the folks who are involved actively in the work of ecumenics. My own theory on that is simple, that we in the academic world, those of us who worked in it, or still do, are somewhat trapped by a German model of the university. So we think in terms of departments, and we think in terms of our work as being work which has a boundary around it, which is determined by disciplines and by professional societies and by university departmental thinking. And it's very tough to break out of that. And ecumenics simply demands, by its very nature, an interdisciplinary approach where sociology and psychology and history and economics and a lot of different disciplines have to converge if we're to deal with this very tough question of the unity of the church. Very little progress is made on that. I could go on at length as to what happened in Vancouver on that or what did not happen and might have, but that would go too much in depth on that one. A seventh one is the one that most people talk about most often, and that is the tension between those who are ecumenically committed in the church and those who are just simply disinterested or uncommitted to the question of unity.
Or you have anti.
And along with that, those who are absolutely anti-ecumenical, inside or out of the church. And you find a lot of anti-ecumenical folks in the Christian church. McIntyres, people like Rob and others who really make it a full-time job to critique and criticize and undermine, if possible, the work of the World Council and National Council of Churches, Councils of Churches. And now there's a good bit of money and a good bit of power residing in the anti-ecumenical forces, one result of which is a program like 60 Minutes and Reader's Digest and those kinds of highly orchestrated efforts to undermine the World Council of Churches. That we might want to probe into also. But probably more important than the anti-ecumenical, I think, are the millions. And I suppose we're talking about upwards to 1,000 million Christians in the world. And a large number of that community, apart from the 800 million in the Roman Catholic Church, are actively involved in ecumenical structures by representation only, to be sure. That's why one individual said, that the ecumenical movement is a daydream that's indulged in by the few on behalf of the many. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Ernst Lange said that. And if you want to read a powerful book that deals with this movement, it's by Ernst Lange, a German who suicided some years ago, a staff member of the World Council of Churches at one point, a very sensitive individual. He wrote a book called, it's called And Yet It Moves. And it's the most serious internal criticism of the ecumenical movement that I've ever read. At the same time, the most positive and affirmative about the possibilities that this represents. And sections of the book are his response to a East German theologian friend who keeps saying, why do you bother with the World Council of Churches? We have all of these burning ethical issues in the world, and you are messing around going to these meetings on faith and order that deal with baptism, Eucharist, and ministry, and these questions. And his reaction and response to this close friend who thinks he's just wasting his time on the whole ecumenical effort. It's a very powerful book. So we're dealing here with a serious question of the uncommitted in the church. That is, the question of the unity of humankind and the unity of the church being a relatively low priority on the agenda. My own experience is that this is very true in the North Atlantic world, particularly North America. Very few people get excited about the ecumenical movement. If you do studies in your local parish and list your priorities, in North America, it'd be way down, 12, 13 out of a list of 13 priorities.
Well, look how few people are here now. Yeah. It's indicative of...
That's indicative of the North Atlantic world. I think there's also, but it's not true in other parts of the world. In some parts of the world, it is a matter of survival, you know, psychic and religious survival, the bonds that we have among us as Christians around the world. We may get into some of that tonight at the forum. We're just going to have kind of a press conference discussion of ecumenics and World Council and these issues. But I can remember talking, please interrupt anytime.
How's that feeling in Europe, in the European church?
The North Atlantic community in the West is not unlike it is here. But in Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union, sections of Africa, certainly sections of Latin America, you'd find that the network and the bond, the solidarity among Christians around the world is what permits psychic survival, to say nothing of religious growth. And that is hard for North Americans to understand. We're nursed on individualism and on tolerance and on pluralism and all kinds of things we've grown up with here. And we figure just getting along with each other is enough. And my argument in my work in Washington is that interdenominationalism and cooperation means nothing ecumenically, unless you tackle the tough question of the unity of the church and move beyond minimal, low-risk cooperation.
You see, this is the experience we have. In parts of Brazil where you don't have problems, Lutherans will never mix with Methodists and much less with Catholics. But in the areas of Brazil where you have tensions, let's say the land problem, or in the peripheries of the large cities with slums, you go to meetings. I saw Pentecostal. And Brazilian Pentecostals means something. It means really people who were indoctrinated that Catholics are sons of the devil. That you see Pentecostals coming to meetings of the basic Catholic communities and being attended to. And nobody asked them. There's no proselytizing. In Brazil, as a matter of fact, proselytizing is only of the Pentecostal churches. Yeah. Especially of the new churches that you people are exporting to us, of the very new ones, and this is very interesting to know. And when you go up in the new areas, as we call them, the new colonization in the north, in the beginning you have one pastor and he attends to all denominations, and trouble starts. You know when then the Pentecostal discovered that there are 100 families, so then they send the Pentecostal pastor over there, and the Catholics and the priest. And then all of a sudden, all this community used to be together, then they will be separate and go to different temples.
That really touches also on the last tension. That is a very basic tension that has existed really from the turn of the century, the tension between Christian world communions and the World Council of Churches. I should be more specific there. By a Christian world communion, we're talking obviously about the Roman Catholic Church as the most universal and Catholic of all churches in the world, but also about the Lutheran World Federation, representing 88 million of people in the world, third largest Christian communion, fourth largest after the Reformed, about 80 million, about 99 member churches around the world. Another communion that's organized is the World Alliance of Reformed Churches that has more than 150 million around the world. The Baptist World Alliance, the Anglican Consultative Council, and you could run down the list, including the Salvation Army, the new organization of United Churches, and so on. There's a good bit of tension between these world communions and the World Council of Churches for some of the reasons that Arno just pointed to. World Council people say that you people in the world communions are anti-ecumenical. You are waving the Lutheran flag, for example, all over the world when you should be talking about unity of the church in the local setting.
It goes back to power, too.
And yeah, very, very close to power and money. And the reason the Lutheran World Federation has had such a history of tension on this score dates back to 1948. Prior to the formation of the World Council of Churches, a huge debate took place about how the ecumenical movement was going to be organized. Some people said, we want to have local member churches geographically distributed, having membership in the World Council directly. That is how the policy now exists. That is how the World Council is formed, by member churches. Church of Norway, Church of Sweden, LCA, ALC, the Batak Church, the Church of the Augsburg Confession in Brazil, all individually are members of the World Council. The other possibility was that confessional communities, called that in those days, would join the ecumenical structure and form the building blocks, the Anglican Communion, the Lutheran Communion, whatever, Orthodox communions around the world. And a very, very serious debate took place until 1948. And then they voted not to go that route. And they put something in the Constitution which says the Central Committee of the World Council will be constituted with due regard to geography, confessional allegiance, and so on. So there's a nod to that, but very little creative work has been done on it. And at the Yale Divinity School in 1954, after the Evanston Assembly, Visser Tuft, the General Secretary, met with a small group of General Secretaries of World Communions. He just gathered them informally, and his point was, he said, I think we're in danger of having an important ecumenical ingredient drop out of the picture. And we didn't intend that to happen. That was only 8 years after Amsterdam, 48. 6 years later, he saw this happening. And he said, I think you secretaries of world communions, World Alliance, Luther World Federation, Anglicans, and so on, should meet regularly and find ways to relate to the work of the World Council. So for the last 20 years now, over 20 years, there has been an annual meeting of what's called a Conference of Secretaries of Christian World Communions. It used to be World Confessional Families, but we're the only ones, along with the Reformed, maybe, who want to think in terms of confessional families. It doesn't apply to the Orthodox, Salvation Army, Quakers, Mennonites, and they're all World Communions. And that group some of us have been working with now for nearly a decade, and they're sort of on the periphery of things. At Vancouver, they're all lined up like birds along the wall, you know. Karl Mao, Edmund Perre of the World Alliance, head of the Anglican Consultative Council, and were all perched along the wall beside you people who were the delegates in making the decisions. So even symbolically, you're marginalized in the ecumenical effort. And one tension that is demonstrated by that also relates to the bilateral dialogue network that's been developed as over and against multilateral work of the World Council. Multilateral simply means all the churches are involved, like in the development of the Lima text on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. But since 1965, a growing network of bilaterals has developed. Regional bilaterals, local ones, and many at the international level. In Romania, for example, they're going into their 33rd dialogue session between Lutherans and Orthodox in Romania. The Finnish have been in dialogue with the Russian Orthodox Church. The West German EKD has been in dialogue with the Church of Greece. Now we have DDR Lutherans in dialogue with Bulgarian Orthodox. And we have at least five places in the world where we Lutherans are engaged in bilateral dialogue with Orthodox. to say nothing of Catholics, Methodists, Baptists, and the whole network. That's part of what some of our responsibilities were in this effort. The international dialogue between the Orthodox and the Lutheran just started after 7 years of preparation, and we attempted to build on the advances of the regional dialogues and then run the thing at a world level with all 14 autocephalous churches of the Orthodox East involved. That's happening quite apart from the World Council of Churches, quite apart from it. And the Constitution of the World Council doesn't permit it, doesn't allow for bilateral dialogue.
So it doesn't allow for it?
There's no structure within the World Council that would say Faith and Order does not organize dialogue between the Methodists and the Quakers.
It has to be from the individual groups.
Yeah. And
it's educating those individual groups to the importance of the dialogue then. I mean, could the World Council be involved in that?
They have observers present. But bilateral dialogue is antithetical to that basic constitutional thing that I mentioned. They don't want to encourage confessional identity. They want to encourage growth in unity. Some of us are saying that we Catholics or Catholics have business to do with the Lutherans. Historically, we have things we have to talk about and work through before we can move into the ecumenical movement. Now there's or move in, you know, before we can tie up with some of the programs of the World Council. But the Lima text on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry, for example, would never have happened had there not been bilateral dialogues going on the last 20 years. It was a very fruitful cross-fertilization between the two. And the multilateral efforts influence bilateral. So no one writes on the question of Eucharist without taking very seriously what the Lima text says about it. And the Catholic Lutheran document is visible in the Lima text. So it's a very, it's a complementary thing, but also a good bit of tension exists between the two. Well, let me stop there. I could go on at length, but I think that's enough.
First half hour.
Now pick anything you'd like to pick.
Well, just picking up a little bit of the last part, when you were in Geneva, with the bilateral talks and so on, did you sort of ride the fence there? Did you sometimes think one was hampering the other, or did you sort of feel there was a creative tension, or was the tension more... Do you understand the difference that I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, part of my task was to relate the Lutheran World Federation to the World Council of Churches, a rather messy task. And because of the history of 30 years of tension between the two organizations...
In the same building.
So we were kind of a target of criticism. Conrad Reiser, Associate General Secretary, is a Lutheran, and I and others tried to stage a reconciling event, we would call it, but in fact it was a horrible confrontation. And what happened was we said that as a result of Nairobi, Section 2 of Nairobi, when a statement was made that the World Council should nurture and foster better relationships with the Christian world communions. That was on paper. It's also on paper from Vancouver, but it was never discussed, never debated. Sort of a non-event in Vancouver. We took that seriously, and we said, now look at the tensions that have gone on for 30 years in this house between these two organizations. Let's try to get to the bottom of that. So we prepared a consultation in the attic above the Bosse Chapel, where we had Philip Potter and Karl Mao, three members of the Central Committee of the World Council, three members of our Executive Committee, Andreas Orflot, Primate of Norway, cool at best about ecumenics, didn't even appear at Vancouver, sent some others to go. Mm-hmm. So we had these people faced off in a room half the size of this one, sort of knee to knee for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And Dorothy Marple and Annie Jaggi, the lawyer from Uganda, former Vice President of the World Council, were trying to chair that thing, and they kept saying, please, let's be nice with each other, you know? And we had 2 days of surfacing of really unhappy things that had developed over 20, 30 years. We had to get that all out. And then we started to reconstruct. And we had on paper, by the end of the meeting, an aid memoir, they called it, with concrete steps that might be taken for us to get over the obstacles that have been in the way for this in this relationship and to make things better. I don't think it's gotten a whole lot better.
I don't understand too much about the background to that. Is it the kind of thing that would be obstacles to other churches as well, or is it a particularly Lutheran thing, I mean, in terms of doctrine or way of looking at things?
In this instance, it was a Lutheran World Council issue, and primarily, as Arnold said, we're in the same building with 150 staff, and they have about 270, so you can see the size question. We're very visible. and sort of a symbol of the anti-ecumenical activity of world communions. It is a misplaced anger. The United Methodist Church, United Presbyterian Church, USA, each have larger international program budgets and staff than the entire World Council of Churches. So our argument was, if you want to target a problem, target some of your member churches, like the United Presbyterian Church or United Methodist Church. Don't look at our LWF. But the tensions reside very often around competition, overlap, feeling of a hindrance that's presented by the Lutherans in terms of local unity efforts, where local churches become dependent upon money from Germany through the LWF, and hence are hesitant to merge with another church in local unity, and also in world service programs. We have a massive operational world service and refugee program in the LWF, probably the most efficient in the world.
Yes.
And as a result of that, the World Council, which is not programmatic, not operational is the term they use, they encourage local ecumenical cooperation, and that takes on a different shape. In order to encourage local unity, they work only through local resources. The Lutherans have argued our job is to save lives when people are dying, and we do that in the most efficient way possible. And if we have to bring in a Danish agriculturalist to bring this off, we'll bring in a Danish agriculturalist and do the job right. So you had that tension over the years.
That tension is the same thing, for instance, within South Africa with regard to the individual churches of the South African Council of Churches. Who also tries to head up, for instance, relief work on an ecumenical basis. But a lot of the churches go ahead and raise money and do it on their own. So in fact, you know, it's not only worldwide with the World Council, but I'm sure you find that sort of tension in all different countries.
Same tension. Absolutely.
With the local ecumenical group.
Yeah.
Pilinski in Caracas told me that the World Council of Churches is funding help for refugees in Central America, and they are doing it through the Lutheran World Federation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it seems that this is the operational thing that you're talking about.
The other argument is that in some instances the World Council simply can't enter a region. Like I could not get into your country. I got caught in the Johannesburg airport up in that upstairs section and there for 2 days going to Gaborone, Botswana. But they would not let me out of the building. And by the very virtue of the fact that I was residing in Geneva, a member of an ecumenical kind of community. So I think what's involved there in terms of opposition quite often ties up with the fact that the LWF is respected as an operational unit. And when the World Council cannot enter an area, or even the United Nations cannot enter an area, they will they'll run their money through the LWF. Some $20 million of dollars, I think, last year came through United Nations office of Danish pastor, I was ahead of it, but the High Commissioner for Refugees of the United Nations, then would say we move through the LWF at this point, very quietly and silently doing that, because they couldn't achieve their goals any other way. Natural attention comes.
I have another question, but this tension, you're always talking about the Lutherans, and does the same kind of tension exist between the Methodist Communion and the Reformed Communion and the Anglican Communion with the World Council of Churches?
It's there, but it's not as dramatic, because the World Alliance of Reformed Churches has 5 staff, and they argue that all of our resources are being plowed into the World Council of Churches and we're working ecumenically. My point is, look at the United Presbyterian Church, not at World Alliance. And the Baptist World Alliance has Helmut Claus, the new General Secretary in Washington, a West German man, with about 4 or 5 staff in the Baptist World Alliance. So they have no big structure like the LWF. World Methodist Council, Lake Junaluska, has a General Secretary and 2 staff sitting there. So they have remained very low profile. So they're the real issue is United Presbyterian Church, not World Methodist Council. And United Methodist Church sees the World Methodist Council in competition with its international work. Uh-huh. So there you've got an internal problem. Bill Cannon, that group is not looked upon with favor by
the world. So part of it is very simple, that someone's saying, well, I want to do it my way. And another part is just the ego power thing that we did this. We got to India first.
Yeah.
Very unchristian.
And then part of it was the Lutheran and World Council is just by being in the same building with two power structures. But the question I have that's a reality that we have right now. And I guess I, envisioning beyond that, how is there going to be movement beyond that? Is there anything active? Is there any, not a study group, but is there any movement towards breaking through that? Because once you get to a power position, whether you're 5 in an office or 157 in an office, if you are the power position, you don't want to give that up because it's your office, sort of your... And is there anything happening in that that you know of personally?
There's a lot going on. And it centers on the question, in terms of theology, on the ecclesiology question. Mm-hmm. What is the nature of the church? The decision...
So it goes back to the doctrine goes...
Would back up to the top one in some ways, but more than that, linking doctrinal question with concrete ethical questions is the key here. In 1977 at Dar es Salaam, we Lutherans, as you know, made a decision regarding apartheid in South Africa. And there we're talking about the same thing John's talking about downstairs, but the decision to declare apartheid a issue status confessionis, meaning that when the sisters and brothers can't come together to celebrate the Eucharist, black and white people, that violates our basic Lutheran understanding of the church in terms of Article 7 of our confessions. So they looked at our definition of the church and said, this violates our fundamental understanding of the church. Now once that happened, people began to say, what on earth have we done? You see, we are not a church as the LWF. We are a loose federation of 99 member churches around the world. So some of us wrote a paper in 1979 I and Harding Meyer from Strasbourg both wrote our papers separately, but we said the same thing down at Joinville in Brazil at the meeting and said, look, we have acted as a magisterium in Dar es Salaam. We have acted like a Roman Catholic Church, pointing to their canon law and saying, here's an ethical implication for that. That's acting like a world church. So we didn't say we are a world church. We simply said, by that action, we Lutherans have got to look at the question, what is the nature of the global Lutheran communion? Does it have some marks of a church? Is it only a strange, loose federation? Why do we define our churches by the Pacific Ocean, or Atlantic Ocean, Mexico and Canada, and the LCA, for example? What's holy about a geographic or a national boundary? We're talking about the church. So the issue of the global expression of our Christian faith has come up as a result of this. And that is the same issue that is being raised more and more in the World Council. Is the conciliar process taking on marks of the church, or isn't it? Mm-hmm. And some big advances happened there. That would be getting much too technical here without the documents. But very big advances were made in Vancouver on this one, saying that we must start a process of confessing our faith as a world church. That's written into the documents, a process of confession. Ulrich Dupro and John
DeBruschi
and others have been involved in this activity leading up to that kind of accident in Vancouver. To me, the most important thing that occurred in Vancouver, with no publicity at all, but for the future of the ecumenical movement, it will be the most crucial contribution of Vancouver, linking doctrine and concrete ethical.
That was precisely my question. This is a very helpful list for me, Dan. But I sort of went back through it and asked myself, now, are the tensions there because the two elements in each are substantively at odds with or opposed to one another, or are the tensions there because of different emphases that's grown up for historical reasons? Some of them can be resolved.
Yeah.
I mean, the doctrinal versus non-doctrinal may be one that can be, isn't inherently at odds with one another. You could have the Lima document as an outcome of the bilateral, the contributions of the dialogue, the multilateral, at the same time as the increased attention to the social ethical issues, and they're just stronger for their coming together, but they're not inherently at tension with one another. Whereas some of those others may be more substantively at odds. I mean, they build in the contradiction.
Yeah, we titled this Creative Tensions, and that to me means that, that there's some new things emerging from this. Mm-hmm. And quite a number of those items, you could say, we've made progress was made at Vancouver. On number one, the Faith and Order Report listed all the doctrinal advances, Lima and whatever. And then they had a sentence in there, and this is inextricably bound up with our concern for the healing of the human mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, right in the middle of a Faith and Order, doctrinally oriented mm-hmm. thing, they were talking about the healing of the human, which yeah. opened the door to the whole other activity of the World Council. And that same door was opened from the other side in, uh-huh. in documents on justice and peace. No, that's... the local global, some important advance occurred. They're going to set up even an office in Geneva, the General Secretariat, to deal with regional councils of churches and Christian World Communion, we think. Some of us are involved in a core group relating to the General Secretariat, a group elected, 21 of us, elected in Vancouver, a new entity. And the primary task of that new group appears to be to tackle this question of regional council of churches, Christian World Communions, black churches in the U.S., and other elements that are not moving creatively through the present, you know, program and work of the World Council. So advance was made there. On the transconfessional, yes, some evangelicals wrote a three-page, very affirmative document about the World Council Assembly.
It's very good document.
It's worship, it's biblical emphasis.
Yes.
Tremendously important bridge was built. We've got copies of that here if anybody wants to get them. Three or four of us have them with us.
And that
is a new step.
And then there was that Mana report, wasn't there, of those who were evangelicals who were against?
Yeah, well, McIntyre's group.
That's the one that's going to be published in South Africa. You know, this is
or naturally.
Problem.
Yeah. And perhaps in Brazil. In Brazil, perhaps the only thing to be published about Vancouver will be McIntyre's position, because mm-hmm. all that we get comes either through the Washington Post, either especially New York Times, yeah. and Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. So you bet on that.
That's
you
the
bet
president. On that.
But I have something to say. I think that Vancouver, we talked a lot about the nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in a nuclear war, and I don't believe it will come off. Mm-hmm. Really, I don't. And nobody can convince me of that. I respect the positions of others. But that the nuclear threat, that the threat of a nuclear war will help the job
yeah.
of ecumenism is fabulous. I give an example. In Brazil.
Non-doctrinal factory.
Yeah, non-doctrinal factory. In Brazil, when the Catholic Church awakened to the reality of the country and not to the one they were always accustomed to be in a position of power, and this was after Vatican II, you cannot imagine how ecumenism spread. We have CONIC, which is the largest national ecumenical council of churches in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Catholics, Lutherans, Methodists, a small Reformed church, and Episcopals. But 93% of this is really Catholic. And they have in the constitution the Protestant churches have in voting system, although being only 5% in the voting system, we have one vote more than Catholic. Mm-hmm. And this they agreed to because the Methodists wouldn't join. And so why did they say, no, we have to come together? Because they have, the country has big problems. And whenever they speak, they now, from now onwards, they will not, after consulting with the other church, member churches, they will always speak not only as a Catholic Church, but as CONIC, as the National Council of Christian Churches,
mm-hmm.
which gives something very different.
Yeah.
And at the constitution of CONIC last November, I think it was November 18, the Catholic Church sent a very first great delegation of bishops, lay and women.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the nuclear thing, nuclear war that you are not going to have, will help the World Council of Churches very much.
Well, there's a structural problem there though, and that is that the regional councils of churches have no direct linkage to the World Council. Mm-hmm. They're not accountable to the World Council. Programs can be ignored. There's no accountability lines drawn. Because member churches are members around the regional council.
Yes.
And that gets at Janet's question too. That one's going to be looked at. How regional ecumenical programs are relating to the World
Council. But we in Latin America have, besides CONIC in Brazil, there are ecumenical councils in many other countries.
Yeah.
But including the Catholic Church, there are very few. I don't think there's any other Latin American
That's
country.
Acceptable. Yeah? That's very acceptable.
Yeah. But we have the Latin American Council of Churches, which mm-hmm. has many more members. It has 100 member churches, many more than are members of the World Council. And through CLI, we're trying to get more Lutheran in the World Council.
Yeah.
Another question about the Pope.
Are there any, we should get that, some of you may want to also talk about the kind of criticisms that have come up, like, is the World Council a Marxist-oriented organization, or why does it support liberation terrorist groups around the world, the kinds of charges that have been leveled against it in recent years. You may want to touch some of those.
Just briefly, you said, since you don't want, maybe you can pick this up later, the one sort of irony that, in a sense, was the fact that there was a lot of emphasis on peace. A lot of it was in that sort of side group on peace and justice that met in what they call the coffee house.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the speakers were talking a lot about peace, for instance, Coretta King. There was a lot of emphasis on non-violence. And yet that seemed to be ironic with the, on the other hand, and also the statement that they brought out about the nuclear mm-hmm. arms race, mm-hmm. and the arms race in general, I think, mm-hmm. With the support for some of the liberation movements who mm-hmm. use violence. You know, that seemed to be a sort of paradox.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to pick that up.
Yeah.
I have a question about this. Is this the Scott Baptist pastor, Ian Possley?
Paisley from Ireland.
From Ireland, yeah. Well, one of these days he had a picket saying, Martin Luther said. Well, and this, stirred me inside. And I went up to him. And then he said, he began saying that the World Council of Churches supports terrorists and so forth. And he said, give me an example. He said, they supported Zimbabwe. And I told him, no, it was this and this and this. And he said, they supported even the terrorists of Frelimo. Now we come to the question, who are terrorists? For instance, I, as a Brazilian, Portuguese-speaking country, I feel very close to Mozambique. They are also Portuguese-speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very sorry that my government lost the train and did not get on the train when the Frelimo thing started. But Frelimo, for me, were never terrorists. The terrorists were the Portuguese who were inside the country. So we have to define what a terrorist is. Now you come and say that those people of Nicaragua who made the revolution, they were terrorists. Mm-hmm. Now nowadays the contras are the terrorists. So I think that this is all depends when you want to define a terrorist, somebody who is fighting against oppression, against centuries old oppression, and one that at least begin to breathe and to have a life of his own. And you define him as a terrorist because he is against what is called an established government. You have to see what means this government and under which basis this government considers itself as established. Mm-hmm. And when you define this, then you will also come to the conclusion that, for instance, Stroessner in Paraguay is not mm-hmm. a real and a legitimate government. It's the government of Paraguay, but not legitimate. And if you go and go to real free elections, which in Paraguay are impossible because there's no way to organize real free elections. But if you would go down, I think that Stroessner would be defeated.
Yeah.
And this I'm a very close friend, perhaps I'm a bit partial because I'm a very close friend of one of the leaders of liberation for Paraguay, Lino. Very close friend of mine. But you see then this definition, who is a terrorist? But when Ian Paisley told me, Frelimo a terrorist, I said, I cannot go on discussing with you. No sense.
Yeah.
You are centuries back.
Yeah.
So I think this would put it very well on the table. Who are the terrorists?
There's been a long history of that involvement. And I think in commenting on your question too, there's a qualitative difference that was pointed to in Vancouver between global incineration as a result of nuclear war and the violence of the liberation efforts in relationship to oppressive government. So they've often said in the World Council that they certainly do not support violence, but they have given moral support to racially oppressed people, with the statement that they are not passing judgment on the victims of racism. They're saying, you know, if they are driven to violence, you know, it's not encouraged by the World Council, and money is not given for guns, but they respect that community, whether it's SWAPO or the Liberation Front of Rhodesia in 77, 78, and they would then document that the money has gone for refugees and medical care and trucks and whatever to help refugees, with no evidence ever coming out that the money had gone for guns. They also indicate in response quite often that there's no need for the World Council to supply money for guns. There is so much money available in this world for armaments that there's no need. You know, the Russians or Americans or somebody will supply grenades, automatic weapons, or whatever.
Something else, the money that the World Council gives is not sufficient to buy any arms at all.
Yeah.
Just a few rifles.
Well, this statistic too, the liberation grants from PCR represent 2% of the $85 million of dollars handled by the World Council each year. 66 million of which goes to refugee relief, development efforts, and that kind of work. So you're talking about a very limited amount of money, and money that is given specifically for that special fund of the program to combat racism. So every church which gives money to it knows that a decision will be made by a group of 30 people today from around the world who listen to the folks, say, in Namibia, and on the basis of their counsel make the determination. That was the case in Rhodesia. And the Salvation Army, which pulled out from the World Council as a result of that decision, did so by decision in London in the United States, but not in Rhodesia. The local Salvation Army people hit the streets in protest against their world communion, which took that action. So you have there a certain style of decision making in the World Council that's not so well understood in terms of these things.
Conscious attempt to be in touch with the people that it's going to affect rather than
taking their counsel, not just, you know, taking them into account, but actually taking their counsel and making the decision.
I have a thing to tell about this. In Central America, the World Council helps the organization, they helped establish an ecumenical organization named ASAHEA, I think. I'm not pretty sure of the name. Well, this goes again for a very big word. And all the help they gave was for refugees and medicaments and transportation. Well, and the Argentine, remember that Argentina was helping the Salvador government and the Guatemala government before the Malvinas War. And an Argentinian reporter, he made a collage of things, of news, as if the World Council was giving money to buy arms. And this was published by New York Times. And then it was found out that it was a collage of, short news. So that it seemed that really the World Council was giving money for arms. And when the World Council went to the New York Times and proved that it was wrong, the New York Times even published what is this material?
Retraction.
The retraction. Naturally, the first news was big, and the second was very small.
Yeah. Now,
this we know by own experience.
Well, the anti-ecumenical forces are developing and taking really new terms at this point. Mm-hmm. One would be, of course, the documented study done by mm-hmm. Dwight, called Beyond the Pale, a study of the British investigative journalist who did the book Beyond the Pale, which really proved, tracked down and proved the South African government's involvement in millions of dollars of
Georgetown University funded something.
That's another thing emerging now, is Institute on Religion and Democracy in Washington, in relationship to a new group called Project Democracy, has been sort of surfacing recently. And they have also linkages to the United States Information Agency, which have been putting on paper the directive to systematically discredit the NCC and the World Council of Churches. Leon Howell, I don't know if I should put this on tape, but Leon Howell has documents in his hands, a journalist who is writing on these things and is hoping to publish an article in the Post or New York Times very soon, proving that connection, at least indicating that he has the documents. But before we left for Vancouver, he was working on that. I don't know if he's printed that article has been published yet. And that's a new and a very dangerous development. Yeah. Lots of money involved.
What about rumors, too, that in fact the South African government money also goes to this
IRD?
Yes.
That hasn't not been proved at all, even though their offices are on the same floor.
But this guy's claiming proof.
South African government. He has documents. Leon Howell says he can cite documents and provide them. He's not going to say so in his article, but if he's pressed, he says he has the document. That is a rather scary thing.
Yeah. And the worst thing is now, because we had it in South Africa with the organization that was proven later on that the government had in fact funded it, called the... But it was an organization which set out to discredit the South African Council of Churches,
yeah,
and the World Council of Churches. But even although afterwards it was proved that the money came directly from the government and in fact had been decided on government level to set this organization up,
yeah,
the average Christian had taken in all the information,
yeah,
and didn't go back and discredit all that information.
Yeah. So the damage on this could be done no matter what's proven.
So the articles were planted all over Western Germany, mm-hmm, and people in the parish would read in some of the most respected newspapers.
Yeah.
The World Council have been engaging these things, and they have been planted, nurtured by South African government.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, why is this? I mean, what is it? Is it because the World Council is succeeding, or why?
Well, if it weren't, I don't think they'd bother. Well, I think it's because it's interfering with economic interests of our country.
Yes, in fact, that some of the issues that they take up are going to hurt.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to
now, now you come to the point I want you to come.
Yeah.
Everybody always never mentions transnationals and the World Council of Churches. But the Swiss press started a campaign against the World Council in 78 when the World Council really started the program on transnational.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are many examples in the world when all of a sudden you have a coincidence, how it does it says in the pictures, any coincidence, any similarity with real facts is pure coincidence. Well, and you always have these things. And I have a very fact about the Andrea Company, that is the transnational who are fighting against me, and the visit of the World Council of Churches in the Faroe Islands.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. And people think, oh, this is nothing. Yes, this is very well linked.
It's not just economic interests of companies and governments.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah, but it's also military power and relationship. I mean, they've become so interrelated that you almost have to say them together, like military economics. I don't know how you'd say it, but they become so.
There comes to some of these institutions a guy named Arno and gives $5 million and doesn't want to receive. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Where do these $5 million come from?
Mm-hmm.
Not from the Arno.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying Arno.
It's asking for a judgment. It'll take a lot of time, I suppose, to back up. But do you see the anti-ecumenical movement? Two parts. One, growing markedly. And secondly, is it different from the anti-ecumenical movement or elements that we've had in the past? And Ian Paisley and Carl McIntyre, they've been around for a long time. But are we talking about something which is different from that and significant, of a significant scale, or are we talking about the continuation of things that we've had, problems that we've had for a long while?
I think there's a disjuncture. I think there's something new happening, but I don't think it's time has passed enough to be able to evaluate whether it's going to gain momentum. And that to me would be characterized by the near right.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Newhouse, mm-hmm, and other sophisticated theological minds who have identified democratic capitalism so completely with the movement for creation of human freedom and liberation, human rights around the world, that that they cannot see the nature of a world council or multiple systems that impinge upon that kind of discussion. Mm-hmm.
A lot of this is coming, you know, as you say, from the far out, because they see the world council as being too left. Is the same thing happening in communist countries? I mean, do churches who belong to the world council in communist governed countries, do they have to put up with the fact that the communist government sees the world council as pulling them too much to the west, or, you know?
We're going to get into that. We're going to spend a little hour on that, whoever is interested more in Russia.
You hit a point. That is right. That is true.
I talked to a man in Kiev once who confided in me. He said, some of us are very concerned about the fact that our church is a member of the World Council of Churches. And he said, the reason I'm concerned is that we're quite certain it's seriously infiltrated, if not dominated, by capitalists.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
You know, and this whole sort of movement towards ordaining women as being part of the decadent West.
Yeah, undermining.
Like that, rather than...
Yeah. So the same statement of that gentleman could be made by somebody in Peoria that says the whole thing's going communist. You got Russians there voting, boycotting.